Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Namo Vishnupadaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhakta Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deva Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Shunyamari Pashate Desha Tarane Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasri Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Reading from Canto 7, Chapter 13, Verse 43. Vikalpam Juhuyat Chittau Tham Manasi Artha Vibrame Mano Vaikarike Utva Tam Mayayam Juhoti Anu Vikalpam Juhuyat Chittau Tamanasyata Vibrame Mano Vaikarike Hutva Tamayayam Juhotyanu Vikalpam Juhuyat Chittau Tamanasyata Vibrame Manovai Karike Hutva Tamayayam Juhotyanu. Translation: the mental concoction of discrimination between good and bad should be accepted as one unit and then invested in the mind, which should then be invested in the false ego. The false ego should be invested in the total material energy. This is the process of fighting false discrimination. Purport: this verse describes how a yogi can become free from material affection. Because of material attraction, a karmi cannot see himself. Gyanis can discriminate between matter and spirit, but the yogis, the best of whom are the bhakti yogis, want to return home back to Godhead. The karmis are completely in illusion. The gyanis are neither in illusion nor in positive knowledge. But the yogis, especially the bhakti yogis, are completely on the spiritual platform. As confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, mamcha yo vyabhicharena bhakti yogena sevate sagunan samatichaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. One who engages in full devotional service does not fall down under any circumstance, at once transcends the modes of material nature, and thus comes to the level of Brahman. Thus, a devotee's position is secure. A devotee is at once elevated to the spiritual platform. Others, such as Gyanis and Hatha Yogis, can only gradually ascend to the spiritual platform by nullifying their material discrimination on the platform of psychology, and nullifying the false ego by which one thinks, I am this body, a product of matter. One must merge the false ego into the total material energy and merge the total material energy into the supreme energetic. This is the process of becoming free from material attraction. Translation: the mental concoction of discrimination between good and bad should be accepted as one unit and then invested in the mind, which should then be invested in the false ego. The false ego should be invested in the total material energy. This is the process of fighting false discrimination. What is said here is that the lower is merged into the higher or finer, subtler matter, one after the other, until everything is merged into prakriti, total material energy. This is the reverse of the process of coming into the material world and establishing our material bodies. If we look at the material creation, which we'll actually discuss tonight, we can discuss it now actually, and then we don't have to do it tonight. There is a very subtle form of material energy, so subtle that it is imperceivable by anybody. Of course, nobody exists then anyway, so it's very, very, very subtle. It's not manifested at all. It's called avyakta. By the will of the Lord, at a certain point called time, the Lord wills it to manifest. And by His will, something happens, and the jivas are injected by the Supreme Lord from Himself into the matter, and then it becomes vyakta, or visible, manifest, in a very subtle form. This is called Mahatattva. And this Mahatattva is so subtle that it's almost spiritual, because the jivas are in there and the matter is so fine that there's a very slight covering on the jiva. But matter is manifest and the jiva is manifest in the matter. And it is said that the matter is like luminous, it is glowing because of the jivas, the consciousness. Consciousness, we can say, is quite evident there, and matter itself is in a very, very fine state. So sometimes it's called the Hiranyagarbha, or the golden egg. It's like an egg which is all golden. And sometimes in Indian art you'll find a big egg like this, all golden. That's the beginning of the universe. So that's Mahatattva. Very, very fine state of matter manifested when the jiva is present by the will of the Lord and consciousness is there. It's called pure intelligence sometimes also, or buddhi. Because the jiva's consciousness is manifest there quite prominently. But in matter itself, there are other potentialities which begin to manifest in spite of that pure state, and gradually we'll get an appearance of different grosser and grosser elements coming out. So false ego is the first thing that manifests from that. It's always there, but it suddenly manifests. And then it manifests in terms of modes. Sattva, Raja, and Tamas. And then from those modes of Ahankara arise grosser elements, which we're more familiar with. That is the mind. And the devatas actually are manifest at this point. Also the bodies of the devatas are manifest. And from Rajagun is manifested intelligence, material, lower intelligence, and pranas. We have the pranas of the body, and the senses, knowledge-gathering senses, and action senses, that is eye, ear, nose, touch, etc., and hands and feet. These are manifest. Well, of course, they're very subtle. They're not like these hands and feet and all that. They're a very subtle level. And from the mode of ignorance, tamas, arises the material elements and the sense objects. That is, ether is the first manifestation and sound is the sense object. They go together. The medium of sound is ether. And then air is manifest with the sense of touch. And water with taste. And fire with form. And water with taste, fire with form, and then water with taste, and then earth with smell. So we get the different sensations related to the different elements, and then with those we got different senses, and then we got different devatas. So we get devatas on the mind, we get senses, then we get objects or sensations, we go objects of senses, and we get the gross material elements. And they're all manifested. And from this, we get combinations together, and we get gross bodies, and we get subtle bodies, and we have manifestation of material things in the world, and then we enjoy. So the jiva is already there, because that's the first element which makes Mahatattva manifest. So this is the Vedic conception of the creation, so to speak, from subtle to gross. Very, very subtle. It's so subtle you cannot see it. And then the jiva contacts matter, and then it becomes manifest in a very subtle way as Mahatattva. And then gradually Ahankara and mind, intelligence, senses, and the gross material elements and gross bodies manifest. So one after the other. One manifests from the other, so to speak. So if we are going to destroy all of this, as we become spiritual, we're rejecting all of this. We're rejecting the objects and the material body, the gross body and the subtle body and the false ego. So it is described, for instance, in the several times, but particularly in the second canto, how the yogi liberates himself and emerges the lower element into the next higher one, and that one into the next higher one, and that one into the next higher one. So he gets these sense objects and the senses merging into the mind, and the mind merging into the false ego, and the false ego merging into the mahatattva, and the mahatattva merging into the avyakta state. And avyakta, then everything's finished. Then you can't see it anymore. And then the jiva's free, and then he goes to the spiritual world at that point. Huh? So what this means is gradually the jiva gives up his connection or his attachment to these various things. Well, he gives up his attachment to material objects and material body, and then to subtle body. Well, all these things are there. Why are we attached to them? We're attached to them because we want to enjoy. We want to get ananda or bliss. And certainly the jiva must get experience of bliss. He wants that bliss. So therefore, these are there for that purpose, to get bliss in the material world, separate from Krishna. So we have a material world made of gross objects. We have a material body to contact those things and try to get the enjoyment. We have the subtle body to record the impressions. And we have the intelligence to try to find ways of getting that, the enjoyment. And we have the false ego to make us identify with the body so we think we're enjoying. So in this way we have a whole system set up for enjoyment in the material world, from subtle to gross. And we see that even when we go from body to body, the subtle determines the gross again, because it's a subtle body which determines your gross body. We think of different things in our life, and we attain that in our next body. Our gross body becomes is determined by our thoughts, attractions, experiences, likes, dislikes, karmas of our previous lifetime. So the subtle body precedes the gross body. And the subtle body is changed or transformed through our free will and our choices and our experiences. And this is how we go on in the material world. So it works from subtle to gross. So we have to get free from all of these different levels of subtle and gross bodies and karma, etc. So the yogi, it is described, gradually detaches himself from all these things one after the other. It says he merges the lower one into the higher one like that. Even the gross elements manifest gradually, and the earth merges into the next element. Water merges into fire, fire into air, air into ether, ether into mind, mind into intelligence, intelligence into false ego into mahatattva, mahatattva into vyakta. So it's described that this is the process by which the yogi liberates himself from the material world. That looks very complicated for us to do, because we're not even familiar with what these elements are. And I doubt if any yogi consciously is meditating on this and doing this. But the import of this is that we do have to become detached from everything in the gross world and everything in the subtle world. Otherwise, we're bound up. So what this means is we have to be detached from everything. We have to detach from the gross enjoyment and the subtle enjoyment. The gross enjoyment between body and objects, we have to become detached from that. And we have to become detached from the mental pleasures that we may get, experience in the subtle body. Both things we have to give up. But behind that, of course, is the false ego, because we can't have enjoyment unless the false ego is there. Because we won't identify with the body if there's no false ego. And if we don't identify the body, we couldn't enjoy it. So we enjoy it only through the identification with the false ego. Just like when you dream at night, you dream different things, yeah? But who is experiencing that? Is it the gross body that's experiencing it? Yeah, there's somebody else there that's experiencing it. But it's real, is it not? It's as real as this world. And you identify that, and you're not thinking, well, I'm sleeping now, and I'm actually this gross body. You don't think like that. You're in the dream, and you're identifying, and you're doing different activities, and you may laugh or cry or run or scream or do whatever you do in the dream. And it's you. It's you in there. So that's your identification at that point. You're identifying with that particular body. in the dream. Huh? And if you didn't, then you wouldn't have any emotions when you saw it. You wouldn't. Huh? But when you wake up, of course, and you think, oh, that was not real. That was not me. This is me. I'm the gross body, not that subtle body. So then you don't feel anything, and you forget the dream. And doesn't have any significance for you. So in the same way, we identify with this body. But if we were to suddenly wake up, then we say, oh, that was just a dream. I'm not that body at all. So that is exactly what the false ego does. It makes us identify with this body. And we think, this is me. And every time we get a new body, we're thinking, this is me, this is me, this body is me. Okay? But when you get out of the body and you realize it isn't you. Oh, that was like that. And that's the people who go out of the body, they have when they have their near-death experience, they die, technically they die. They go out of the body and then they realize, oh, that's not me. I'm not that body. And they get shocked. Then they come back in the body and they're very confused. So what is this? Why am I stuck in this body like this? That's not me. So people have these experiences, actually. So from that we can understand that this ahankara is very, very strong, and but it's like illusion. It's an illusion. It's a false identification, basically. And the problem with people who go out of their body and come back, actually they don't really understand the spiritual nature so well, but they at least understand their subtle body, not a gross body. That's as far as they may be. They don't understand really, ultimately, the whole essence of spiritual life. Even the devatas don't, you know, and they got very, very subtle bodies, and etc. So, anyway, the false ego is the most subtle manifestation of false identity. It's way up there on the top. And even the devatas, and even Lord Brahma is affected by this. And they're very advanced, very sattvic beings, etc., with very subtle bodies. I think Brahma's body is made out of mahatattva or something like that. Very, very subtle creation. So anyway, and devatas can't really see his body even, because he's so subtle, more than the devatas. So anyway, that false ego is a very, very subtle false identification, very, very subtle. And if we want to get liberated, we have to pass by this identification ultimately. If we do that, finally, then we are free. We're free. We can reject this material world. Get through the false ego. Of course, we then reject mahatattva also. Hmm? Identification with mahatattva. And then we're free. But basically, how you can reject all this? How you can reject all this? So Prabhupada here mentions how the yogis do it, and the gyanis also can do this by a process of forcibly detaching oneself through discrimination, intelligence, etc. You become indifferent to the material world. So that is one process by which we negate everything, reject the gross body, reject the subtle body, reject the false ego. This is the process of negation until only the soul is left. We detach ourselves from everyone and then the soul is there. Then we're liberated. So this is not recommended for several reasons. One, this is very difficult to do. It takes a long, long time to do. And people are not very qualified for it. Not known a qualification in this age to do such a process. It takes many, many births to attain that status. Secondly, even if you attain it, it is based upon negation. I'm not this, I'm not this, I'm not this, I'm not this. So your goal is determined by negation. So you get a negative result. I'm not anything. So this is what impersonal, basically, the problem in it. It's negative. His goal is based upon negativity, the result is negative, minus the material world, that's all it means. So it is liberation, yes, you're free from karma, free from material bodies. But the positive aspects of the spirit soul are not expressed there. And the spirit soul has knowledge, capacity for knowledge, experience, etc., bliss, not manifested in that jiva. He's just pulled out, separated from his material bodies and sitting there as a spirit soul. So therefore not recommended as a complete process. Very difficult, and then it doesn't really give us our dharma, our constitutional qualities, and doesn't manifest it. So the other process is to reverse the whole scenario here by getting to the very root before false ego. And I mentioned that also before. What is the root? The root is our desire to enjoy separately from God. I want to be the center of enjoyment. This is the basic. I want to enjoy. I want to enjoy. That's all. We don't care about anybody else. So that is the root of coming in the material world. That is why the Lord puts us into the avyakta prakriti, and it becomes vyakta and turns into mahatattva, and then we get false ego, etc. Because we have that desire. If we get rid of that desire, then actually we are free. We don't have to go through all these technical stages of rejecting one element after the other. If we get rid of that subtle cause of our existence, then we're free. So that is the process of real liberation. That is the process of devotional service. We do it by affirmation, not by rejection. And rejection comes in the process of the affirmation. In other words, we affirm that I am the servant of Krishna. My constitutional position is as the amsa, or as the particle who serves the Supreme Lord. And it is through that I become satisfied. So I try to satisfy the Supreme Lord. And how do I do that? I do that not with any ulterior motive, but simply to please Him. So that is a relationship of love or devotion. When one does something for another person without any expectations. What is the motive? No motive. Only to please that person. That is real, pure love. And we only want to do something so that person will be pleased. Yeah? Well, that is a pure love. Yeah? So this is what we call devotion, or bhakti. And its perfect state is called prema. And it is not something abstract. It is as real as anything in this material world. Basically, in the material world, we're trying to do the same thing. We are trying to establish a perfect relationship by which we can get bliss. And everyone's seeking in the material world for such relationships, and we go on like this as human beings, birth after birth, trying to get those relationships by which we get real satisfaction. So that actually, there's nothing wrong with that, because that's actually what perfection is. But we're doing it in the wrong way. The basis of our action in the material world is we have this avidya or ignorance, we have false ego, we have all this stuff coming down the line, and we're trying to get this relationship, but we're putting ourselves in the center of it. I am the enjoyer. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work. And we get the cover, it's all covered with ignorance, all this is there, and we put ourselves in the center. And well, what's the problem with that? The problem with that is every other jiva also put himself in the center. We try to have a relationship. You can't do that. So there's a problem there. So the only way we can give that up, rectify the situation, is the opposite. And that is, we don't put ourselves in the center. So if we don't put ourselves and we give the love an affection to someone else without that putting ourselves in the center, without expecting to get the enjoyment myself, that is the real position for us. But there's a problem there also. We have to find the correct object, dependable object of our affection. And we cannot give that to any jiva, because the jiva is fallible like us. And he cannot fulfill all of our expectations. He cannot respond in every perfect way, because he's also amsa, like us. But we want the perfect thing, and we're not perfect. So the only thing we can do is we can relate it to the Supreme Lord, who is the perfect person, who has all knowledge and can respond to us in the most perfect way. So therefore, the process of expressing our love is to direct it to the perfect person who has a spiritual body and who has all knowledge and all bliss and all perfections and all qualities, all wonderful activities. So he is the perfect object of our love, because he has all wonderful qualities, all beauty, all strength, everything. We have all the reflection of that in the material world. In the spiritual world, we have what is called relationships, which manifest as rasas. We have service, that is dasya rasa. We have friendship as equals, that is sakya rasa. And we have parenthood, where the object is inferior to us, and we have to protect that person like a parent. That's vatsalya rasa. And then we have the conjugal relationship, like the gopis and Krishna. So all these are relationships of love with slightly different tastes in them. Okay? So those are in the spiritual world. But they're also in the material world, they say. So the jiva has the same propensities to express his love in different ways, and he does that in the material world, just as he does in the spiritual world of Krishna. Huh? Now the difference is that in the spiritual world it's called prema, because it's related to Krishna with selfless love. And in the material world we have exactly the same rasas, exactly the same relationships. What is different is that we don't call it prema, we call it kama. And we are in the center of the relationship. Huh? But why it's like that is because the jiva has these things innate within him, these propensities for love, devotion, etc. But his center is different in the material world. The center is myself, and I try to get my enjoyment there. And real love is to give that up and give it to the object who deserves that love, and that is Supreme Lord. So that is called prema in the spiritual world. It's called kama in the material world. So they're very similar. But there's a difference there. Nevertheless, we try to fulfill ourselves even in the material world with these relationships. And in India, of course, this is all analyzed in dramatic literature, because in drama they're trying to present a replica of the material world, which will invoke your sentiments about the material world. Our sentiments are invoked by relationships. So that's what is presented in drama. There's characters who are people, and they have different relationships. And these relationships keep shifting, and this creates drama. Either comedy or tragedy. And of course, you can examine any presentation. It's representing relationships, basically. Any presentation, whether it's a movie or a play or a musical or anything. It's representing relationships between people. And establishing or breaking those relationships. Okay. And the establishing it gives happiness, and the breaking them gives pain. Basically, that's it. And the whole of a drama is based on that, establishing or breaking, and what happens as a result of that. Depiction of that. And so therefore, in the material dramas also we'll have the same thing as in the spiritual thing. We'll have the same relationships, parental relationships, conjugal relationships, friendship relationships, basically. Dasya not so much, but Sakya and Vatsalya and Madhurya Rasa will be expressed in the material world also. And you can analyze anything and you'll find that's there. But there's one interesting thing. Though these are prominent in the material world, even more prominent in the material world are the secondary rasas. In the spiritual world there's also secondary rasas, like fear, lamentation, anger, raudra rasa, ghastliness, vibhatsa rasa, what else? Comic, hasya rasa, like this. So there's seven secondary rasas. In the spiritual world, they're not primary, they're secondary. The primary rasa is some loving relationship, and these secondary things come in to kind of disturb it a little bit and increase the flavor of that rasa. So within a love affair with Radha and Krishna, then there is anger. Radharani gets angry, Krishna gets angry. And that creates a little bit of tension in the relationship. And then it resolves out again, like this. So they're like little waves. They create little waves in the relationship and variety. But the major thing is the loving relationship. In the material world, sometimes, often, in fact, these relationships become primary. Especially in the dramatic presentations, or especially modern movies, you'll find all the secondary rasas has become primary elements, like horror movies are fear and ghastliness, and the other movies, action movies, are virya rasa, with a lot of violence, also with a lot of vibhatsa and ghastliness in it also. And then we have comic movies, etc., comic relief, that's another one like that. So these become very prominent, and they attract us in the material world. The secondary rasa somehow, somehow the love is there, but then that's overshadowed by these other secondary rasas, because we have base qualities, I suppose, in the material world. So we like these other things for excitement. So like in India, they analyze all these different elements, etc., and how they should be presented to make a proper drama and create proper excitement in the audience like that. So we'll see that even in Western drama, there is a presentation of rasas, basically. And they combine them in different ways to create more and more excitement for the and attraction for the audience. The material world is like the spiritual world, but with all the same elements are there. But in the material world, it is self. Each person is trying to get the enjoyment for himself. In the spiritual world, the center is Krishna. So if we want to get out of the material world, then we have to give up all these attachments. Basically, attachment is to our different rasas in the material world. We'll have attachments. And this is due to rasa. Our nature is to get that taste, but which gives us ananda. So we try in the material world to get our enjoyment through a relationship. Very strong. And if we want to get out of the material, we have to break that relationship, that taste. And we have to give up sense the objects as bodies, or false identification with the body, etc. And then we have to get rid of the false ego. We have to give up all identification. But it's very difficult to do. Give up. So the best thing to do is to get to the whole root of the problem and concentrate on that. And to develop a sense of surrender to the Supreme Lord. And to do something out of pure devotion or pure love. To start a little bit. To do something without any expectations. Just out of expression of affection or love for the Supreme Lord. Why? Because he's the most beautiful. He has the most wonderful qualities. He has the most wonderful activities. He is the most perfect in all ways. He's a perfect object of our affection because he will respond in the proper way and satisfy us in all ways. So we try to do that more and more. Well, then, automatically, all these other attachments will become less and less. The more we have attraction for Krishna, the less we'll have attraction for the material world. Because the process of attraction for Krishna is a process of giving up one's own motivations. In other words, we lessen our degree of kama and increase our degree of prema in the process of bhakti. So the increase of devotion to Krishna automatically must mean the decrease of material attachment, because they're opposites. We put Krishna in the center, and that's for prema, and we put ourselves in the center for material enjoyment. So we start from the minus side, that is, very little attraction to Krishna and a lot of attraction for material things. A lot of material identification. But at least if we have a little bit of something for Krishna, a little bit, just a little trace of something, that is enough to start the process. So that little trace is called faith. Shraddha. That is the beginning of the process. And by the process of bhakti, engaging our senses, etc., in a certain way, engaging our body and mind in a certain way, with that favorable little shraddha, then the shraddha or the attraction for Krishna begins to increase gradually. In other words, we begin to lessen our insistence on material enjoyment, and we're willing to give the enjoyment to Krishna more. So that gradually increases and increases and increases. As that happens, less self in the center. Until there's 100% for Krishna, 0% for Maya. Then that is the perfection, that is called prema. And if that's so, then you're out of the material world. And you don't have to worry about all this process of merging one element to the other anymore. It's already finished. Because we get to the root. So that is the most effective process for us. To get to the root and cut that out, then everything else withers away. So any question?
So said when somebody lays their body in the dam, that they achieve liberation. So of course some persons, they may not be on the platform of, not identifying with the body or the elements or whatever. So is that just automatically overlooked or automatic in that process that identification is burnt away, or?
Well, yeah, it will depend, of course. Like every act of devotion has the possibility of taking us to the spiritual world. We read in Nectar of Devotion, for instance, if you put the garland on, then you go to Vaikuntha. Immediately go out to Vaikuntha, like that. Or if you take prasadam or something, then you go to Vaikuntha, whatever like this, And of course, Prabhupada mentions there that it may look exaggeration, but it's not exaggeration. It may not happen immediately in all cases, but there are cases where it does happen immediately also. In any case, it always has some good effect on us. So I think we could say the same thing about passing away in the Holy Dham, that it can give that, in some cases it does, but even if it doesn't give that directly, still one definitely advances by that, because it's an act of devotion also. If one has sincerity, if one is completely, you know, asura, and just comes to them there to exploit it, and then hoping that he'll get out of his sinful reactions by dying in the Dhamma, that is, you know, like chanting on the strength of the holy name. So that's very bad. He's not going to get anything good from that. So it's a matter of one's intentions also. And one has very sincere intentions, of course, the Lord can do anything. Because the Lord, when he killed Putana, he took her to the spiritual world, and she's not qualified. But he took it to the spiritual world. The Lord can do anything that he wants. But he has to see a little bit of something. So in Putana, he saw that, well, at least she offered some milk. Even if it was poisonous. Did something. Okay, she's a big demon. But anyway, she acted like a nurse. So okay, put her in the spiritual world. Well, that's very rare, of course. So for anyone who's a sincere devotee, then the Lord, if he may, show extraordinary mercy by any act you do, especially if it's a difficult time at death or whatever. And if he sees you've done something, you know, very positive for him, then he may do that. He'll take you to the spiritual world just because of that. So we can never, you know, think that anything is done in vain and everything. And the Lord can do that also. But he may not, of course, if he thinks that you still have, you know, you need to, yeah, do something. He may keep you here also. It's up to him.
Someone makes quite a lot of advancement in spiritual life. Say they may fall away from devotees and get one more covered over and have a simple life.
Yeah.
Maybe they can move the world like that. How is it that, that whatever advancement they make, they never lose?
Well, when we do devotional service, we start with a little shraddha. And as we do it more and more, then of course our attraction for Krishna increases. Now, there is an instability there, all the way up to nishtha. And we can always fall away at any point there. Because it is not very strong. You know, it's like we have maybe 2% attraction for Krishna and 98% attraction for Maya. So it's a little dangerous. And if we get to nishtha, maybe we get 50-50 or something. I'm not sure, but something, you know, we get maybe more than 50-50, maybe 60% for Krishna, 40% Maya, like that. So in other words, we've got an advantage that we're more stable than we are unstable. Our attraction for Krishna is more than our attraction for material energy. Even then, is that little attraction is there still. And that'll be there even up in bhava stage, where there's 1% attraction for material energy, or 0.1 or something like that. And there's 99.9% attraction for Krishna. That little spot is also an instability. It can create problems. It may not, but it can. So therefore, Bharat Maharaj forgot everything. He was in a stage, that little something, and then that ignited something. Forgot everything, and he became a deer. So, as long as we're in the material world, then that danger is there. And even in the high state, some danger is there. And with prema, no, it cannot happen. In bhava, it can happen. In any lower stage, definitely it can happen. It's interesting to know, however, that on the stage of bhava, it's not just material desire that's so powerful to do that. It's actually affected aparad. Aparad is the one that the thing that kind of influences even up there. The sinful reactions, all that, are no longer effective in bhava. But aparad, devotional aparad, can linger, have lingering effects even on that stage of bhava, and can influence you. So especially Vaishnava aparad, that's very strong. So that's why we say one should be, you know, careful of all aparads, especially the Vaishnava aparad, because those can create obstacles in devotional service all along the way. So one who falls away from devotional service, of course he can fall for different reasons. One is aparads, in which his taste for Krishna decreases instead of increasing. He gets destroyed, or maybe completely destroyed if it's a serious aparad. So therefore he'll leave and maybe not come back. And next birth, nothing will happen. He won't get it. Nehavakarnasasti is good, but if aparad is committed, the same rule does not apply. If you do a regular sinful activity, yes. You could get born as a Sudra, but the faith can be there, not destroyed. And in the case of Bharat, he became a deer, but his consciousness was the same. He did not lose his spiritual status, even in the body of a deer, and it was manifest again in the next lifetime. So one could become a Sudra in the next lifetime, but you may have good consciousness, the same as the other consciousness. If it was only sinful activity he did, then, in other words, the spirit soul has got its level of attraction to Krishna. But due to its karmas and its sinful activity, his body may be something else. So in that way, there's no decrease in terms of his faith going from body to body, if it's only a sin, accidental sin. If it is aparad, then of course the bhakti itself will decrease. Of course, now, so why does one fall off in the material world? One, of course, is aparad. Another is improper execution of devotional service. Third is, he may not have any faith to begin with. So he only superficially did the activities, and he probably had material desires to fulfill. And then he left and got his material desires fulfilled or frustrated, and he leaves. One of those, the three basic things are there. But if one has done devotional service, and yes, improperly he may perform, so he doesn't advance, so he gets frustrated, goes back to the material world, lives like an ordinary person. That faith, whatever it is, as long as he's not committed aparad, it'll stay with him in the next lifetime, whatever he's achieved, and it can manifest again in the next lifetime. Under different circumstances, then he'll start some devotional activities again.
You mentioned about met in a subtle state, known as pure intelligence. Is it pure material?
What's that?
Is it pure material intelligence?
Pure intelligence. That's what, yeah, pure buddhi. The buddhi, mahatattva is called buddhi. The buddhi element.
Is it spiritual or
it's... It's almost spiritual. It's described almost spiritual. Because the jiva is there, and matter is there, but matter is in a very fine state. So it's not covering the jiva very much in that state. So it's a very fine thing, permeated with the jiva's consciousness, so to speak. So it's called buddhi. Usually, and actually many commentators say that when we talk about, you know, the prakriti, ashada prakriti, you know, bhumiapo nalovayu, kamuna buddhir eva cha. Buddhi is not really this intelligence, it's that intelligence, mahatattva. So the buddhi is called mahatattva. And in the list of the elements, the 23 elements, that buddhi is the mahatattva element also. Mostly because mahatattva is there, but it's not called mahatattva there. Sometimes it's called mahatattva, sometimes it isn't, it's called buddhi.
That's the same, and we start with less faith, less faith in Krishna, less attachment for Krishna, and then more attachment for material energy.
Yeah.
And slowly we go here, right?
Yeah.
That progression, what are the factors actually that affect the progression? Like, is it the number of years we just carry on devotional service, our sincere desire?
Yeah. What is a determining factor in creating progress? Well, there are many elements, actually. Motivation. Motivation depends upon? Goal. We have to be motivated for a certain goal somehow or other. So we have to know what the goal is and become attracted to that goal. And specifically understand what the goal is. And this will motivate us to get there. That's one thing. Second is, if we do have the goals, then we have to have a mechanism to achieve the goal. Yeah? Practical mechanism to achieve the goal. That is called sadhana bhakti. But we have to do that in the proper way. So we have to develop skills in that direction to execute the bhakti properly. We have to know how to execute it properly. We have to have the knowledge at the execution, what is the proper way to execute it, and then we have to practice becoming skillful at it. Those things are there. So we've had that. Basically, we can succeed and we can achieve the goal. And we know the goal, we have motivation to get there, we have a process to do it, and we do the process properly, and we develop our skill in doing it, then we can achieve it, like any goal. So if we don't do that, then of course there'll be problems. if we have no motivation, no goal, and don't know the proper process, and there's no proper execution, then we will definitely have problems. We may get a little something, then again, it may be very slow. Then the other thing, of course, is that, of course, this is an aspect of knowledge, is that we do activities which discourage bhakti, that is, aparads and things like that, weeds in devotional service. So those things will also tend to interrupt or cause problems. So that's actually due to lack of good knowledge. And of course, one other factor there is that everything, the knowledge and the execution and the goal are encouraged or strengthened by association. A mercy. And if a mercy of guru and devotee is there, and Krishna, it's Krishna's mercy actually, it's all Krishna's mercy through the guru and through the devotees. When I get that mercy, then it becomes easy. But how do we get the mercy? Submissiveness. Humility. Humility is necessary to get the mercy. Receptiveness. But
this was
but
Om Namo.
I'm going to this was in the Bhagavatam we have a few descriptions of creation, for instance, or Brahma, then Maitreya, when it speaks to and it all seems like all quite different. How can the approach get some understanding?
Different from?
From each other.
Which ones?
Creation is explained by
third canto. Third canto.
It's different. From explanation given by Maitreya Muni to Vidura.
In which aspect? As far as I know, they're generally very similar. The one element comes out of the other, and that one comes out of the other, and gradually from the subtle to the gross. But that's the basic idea, anyway. And the basic elements are the same. Then there's a secondary creation.
Then one, there as well some differences. Not like 50%
of whatever. Oh, yeah. There may be something, they'll add something else in there, and there'll be another stage in there, something like that. So that one will give more details in one aspect, and one will maybe give some other details in some other aspect. Then you have to stick the two together and the final version, merge the two together and see which is the, you know, the final sequence or whatever like that. The other point, of course, is that with the manifestation of Lord Shiva, the material world, he describes coming out of Lord Brahma, out of his, you know, forehead, out of anger. And then he has other ways of manifesting himself, out of the leg of Vishnu or something like that. So at different times, different things will happen also in different creations. And it'll be slightly different process. The general thing is the same. The details may sometimes be a little different also. So it's not always, things are not always manifesting exactly the same way. But the principle is the same.
You mentioned that we cannot reject the thing, but we have to appreciate it as a subtle thing by understanding that we are serving to the Lord.
And then acting like that and developing the attraction for Krishna more
and
more.
That I reject all other things, and that's a good thing. And but even that also, with the mood of just to please him, that is called pure love.
Yeah.
Then, how do we explain to someone when we're doing some activities, okay, this is that, this is an activity, it's like I'm trying to serve,
yeah.
play on praising Krishna, put in your own way. But how do we determine it to be like, how do we understand that it, yes, his motivation is just to praise Krishna?
Well, it's always part and part. As long as we're in the material world, eh? As long as we're not in prema, it's going to be mixed. Definitely be mixed. It's only a matter of degrees. But if there's a little bit of something for Krishna, fine. Because it's through this that we'll increase by doing these activities. We'll get a little increase. In the beginning, we have no desire to do anything for Krishna. It's hopeless. So the only way we can do it is by accidental contact of devotional service without our even knowing it. That's called agata sukriti. But it does have effect. Even that has effect. Then gradually through agata sukriti, birth after birth, then you know, you develop faith. Once you get faith, that becomes a conscious thing in which you, with your intelligence and determination, you do things for Krishna. So that's a higher stage. But even then, of course, we still got material, you know, faith is just a little bit of speck of surrender to Krishna, and we've got all these material desires still. But with that little faith, we do something for Krishna, and by doing more and more things for Krishna in this way, then the attraction for Krishna gradually increases. So it's not left to accident at that stage. It's with our intelligence we can do these things. So that's when why faith is more advantageous than accidental devotional service. I asked the other day, Jabhadag was talking about, you know, the someone was doing this hypnosis to find out about past lives. So I asked him, well, is there any incident of a person that they took him back through hypnosis into previous lifetimes and they were an animal? So then he thought about it, and he said, well, there's one case of someone, this doctor, doctor, psychologist, the person was a butterfly. I don't know how you describe their life, because how they see is much different from how we see. But anyway, he was a butterfly, it looked like, in that lifetime. I don't know how he described that. And then he went into the temple, or some big building with luxuries, you know, columns and stuff like that. But then he saw some fruit, and he wanted to eat the fruit. So he alighted on the fruit. And then someone came along and swatted him and killed him because he was taking the fruit. And then he got became a human being in his next lifetime because he took the prashad of the Lord. That's a story. I don't know if it's true or not. So because he took the taste of the prashad of the Lord, he got killed. But anyway, he became a human being in his next lifetime. So he got some advantages just from that accidental association with devotional service. Whatever. So in the beginning, that's how we get our faith, is through accidental things like that. But then when we do them consciously, then it's more effective. Because we're favorable, and we're trying to do it favorable, so that is much more effect for us, and it creates a better situation for us.
Actually, we want to go around
and
do it, like killing
animals
and
saying
Hare Krishna,
or killing insects and saying Hare Krishna. Oh, no, we're not. We're not supposed to interfere with their life in general. We try to avoid that, because then it's a problem for us, you know, that we're creating violence. So we shouldn't interfere with them. We can say Hare Krishna to them, no problem. We don't have to kill them. Because they will get the advantage anyway, just by that. It's not the killing that gave the butterfly his elevation. It was he took the prashad. So he could have flown away, and next lifetime he would have got a human birth anyway, not without getting killed.
What about defending a god and things like that? Because now, I mean, is that okay to defend a god? You know, the god tells them to stop them from being.
Well, for the service of Krishna, yeah, something like that. Definitely.
And is it wrong to understand that the person is developing the pure love? I mean, that when they do that, you have to follow the procedure that's been recommended. If you follow the process, if you're not following the person, but you're still pretending that you can be developing pure love, it is not. Of course, you've got some attachment, some thing, but that can be determined in due course of time, and is really.
Definitely. That is why what is the definition of devotional service? It is anukana Krishna nosilam. That's the definition, not hearing, chanting, all that. The basis is actually the favorable attempt, the attempt to please Krishna. Anukana Krishna nosilam, with your activities, whatever they are. So that is the basis. So that's actually the goal of our devotional service. We can say one of our goals. So if we're not conscious of that, and we do the activity, then we'll tend to forget where we're going. I'll do the activities without any goal. Yeah, so that always has to be kind of the center of our activities, that we're trying to please Krishna in that. And we're not trying to do anything for ourselves for that activity. Then that act of devotional service becomes very powerful too. Bring about more attraction for Krishna. It will have some effect if we're not conscious of anything, we're not remembering Krishna, we just do the act. Yes, it has some effect. It's like a Gata Sukriti, it's Nama Bas. It has some effect, but it's slow. Whereas if we consciously put the effort into doing it like that, then we'll have much powerful effect.
Like I said, some of those devotees now are not coming here so much, you know, they're doing work, they're studying, they're doing different things.
Mm-hmm.
So, because we're conditioned human beings, we kind of think, you know, just our mind will think, oh, you know, what are they doing now? You don't see them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You think something maybe negative, you know, they're not doing emotional service, but they might be, what they're doing is, might be totally different. They might have a different attitude, so. I'm rejecting saying if you're not at the temple, then have a program, your own program at home. That way, you're not going to get lost.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Because you can get lost if you're out there, you know, material nature. But just wish we didn't have that attitude. You know, we think just because someone's just not coming here,
mm-hmm.
to the main temple, that they're not doing anything.
Yeah.
Right? They might be doing.
Yeah.
Learning lessons, right? Krishna might be teaching them.
Yeah. Of course, everybody, according to qualification, one performs a devotional service. So. And one cannot jump to a higher qualification artificially. So different people are at different stages, and they may have to perform their devotional service in a different way. Some can do it in the temple, in an ashram. Some can do it close to the temple in that situation. Some have to do it far away. You know, they're all different. People are different. And there are different stages of attachment and, you know, detachment. Nevertheless, they all get the credit because they do recognize Krishna and they're trying to do something, so that much is good. But the further away you are, the more likely it is you'll progress slowly and some difficulty and you know, some problems in such an arrangement also. So one has to be very careful if one is in that position.
So I mentioned from the stage, she said, you know, I was going on with some problem, but she said, she gave an interesting thing. She said that like a lot of time we think about our devotees, you know, we don't think about our own life. How we're going and keep focused. And she said it's like if you had people in your house working for you, but they were always next door asking the next door neighbor if they'd like them to do something. You're paying them, but they're next door asking the next door neighbor, can they serve that person?
Mm-hmm.
And she said the mind's like that. We're always thinking in someone else's life.
Mm-hmm.
We should have our mind and our senses engaged in our own life,
serving
our own devotional service, rather than doing what another person is doing.
Yeah.
They're not doing this or they're not doing that.
Yeah. Yeah.
We don't know, do we?
Yeah.
What the other person.
Well, how do you put that? Devotions with priorities? Like, first we should we should chant, or we should visit the class, or we should do devotional service. Where should we put our priorities? Because, I mean, we have our it's open.
Yeah. That's an individual thing. One is your individual preferences, of which you get more taste for. That's one thing. Of course, we should get taste from everything, but nevertheless, we have our individual preferences. Another is our strengths and weaknesses. We may be weak in some areas, so we have to increase that. If we don't know anything, then we should start reading something, yeah, to learn something. Yeah? So that's another thing we have to concentrate on, are the weakness areas, and try to develop those. Another is necessities. Sometimes some services may be necessary, so we have to also be flexible enough to adapt ourselves to fulfill those needs. Huh? Maybe you have to do some deity worship or something because there's no one there, so you have to do deity worship. Huh? So it's many, many different things. So the best thing is the proper attitude. And that we should understand our goal is actually to develop our attraction for Krishna, and all of these different activities are for that purpose. They're all for that purpose. So we should do them all with a positive mood, basically.
My sage said that it was so technical. Prabhupada Maharaj, how much that type of knowledge relevant for the devotees?
No, this description? Oh, basically not. This is for the yogi.
what is Jnana Mishra Bhakti? How it's connected with creation?
Oh yeah, well we have Karma Misra and Gyan Misra Bhakti. In Gyan Misra Bhakti, one does devotional service, but one also has a desire for liberation. You want to get liberated also. Well, it's obviously a contradiction in one sense, because through devotion we're trying to serve Krishna as a person, and Gyan Misra Bhakti we're trying to get mukti, merging into the Supreme Lord. Someone can use devotional service as a means of attaining liberation. It's not a very good means, but you know, it's not a good thing to do. But you can do that. In fact, a lot of people who follow Shankaracharya do that. It's not actually bhakti because they worship devatas, but they utilize the lower levels up to a certain stage in pursuit of their liberation. So they'll worship the deity Durga or Shiva or Krishna or whatever as a means of stabilizing the mind and, you know, developing their attention powers, etc. And after they've stabilized their mind, then they'll go for merging into Brahman. So one may have, through devotional service, one may have also that desire just to get liberated. Our goal, our prayojan is Krishna Prema. But some people may not have that goal. They may have the goal, I just want to get liberated from the material world, and I use bhakti as a means of getting detached from the material world. And so that's Gyan Misra Bhakti.
How is connected to the stipulations of tendency? What is stipulation at all?
Oh, well, in Gyan Misra Bhakti, in Gyana, what we call mental speculation, this is to discipline the mind with intellectual logic and studying Vedanta to come to the conclusion that we're not this body, we're a spirit soul, we're a Brahman. And then you meditate on those conclusions. That is what we call the mental speculation. So a logic is used to come to these conclusions, and we convince ourselves logically that this is a conclusion by study of Vedanta and taking Shankara's commentaries and seeing how they fit together and how the conclusion is there, using logic. And then after that, then we meditate that I am not this body, I am the Supreme Brahman.
Impersonal.
Yeah. Of course, oneness also. We can take it literally, but of course we know that ultimately is not possible. So therefore it's mukti, we say. Mukti is where they go out of the material world and they try to become one with the Lord, but actually they're still a spirit soul. Another concept of oneness is oneness in spirit, in the sense that even in prema there's a oneness of spirit, that I belong to Krishna. In that sense, there's a oneness also. Whether what he means here, I don't think he explains too well.
We should take it as
one of the Krishna. I could take it either way. Either he's an impersonalist speaking or he's a devotee.
What is
the No, they will not take them personal mode, no. Yeah. So we'll take it. This means one in the sense that we are cooperating with spirit soul, with a super soul, cooperating with him. Krishna says, my devotee is in me and I am in my devotee. So in that sense, they're one.
Discrimination between good and bad should be accepted as one unit.
What that means is we don't accept them. We don't accept the dualities anymore. Good and bad no longer have any meaning for us. They're all relative things. In other words, like I'm in the material world, sometimes I'm hot, sometimes I'm cold. I like this, I don't like this. One and the other. So we become detached from that. It's all the same. No more meaning for me. So we become callous or indifferent to the extremes of the material world, happiness and distress, hot and cold, success and failure, good and bad, all one. It's all the same. It's all illusion. It's all Maya. It's all one. That's this. Okay. Hare Krishna.